Welcome to Portal to Ascension Radio. This is Alan Steinfeld of New Realities. I'm very excited about today's guest. Robert Schock is a geologist, but he's not just a regular geologist studying the rock formations. He actually could be credited with beginning the field of geoarchaeology. In the early 1990s, Dr. Schock stunned the world with a revolutionary discovery that the Great Sphinx of Egypt may be at least 10,000 years old. This is 5,000 years older than anything previously dated. This was inspired by the work of John Anthony West, who just passed on recently. We'll be talking about the contributions of John West to the world and where the work of Dr. Schock will take us from the past into the future, a future about the Earth and all its inhabitants.
Robert, welcome to the program.
Well, and thank you.
Because of your geological studies and sense of being, in a sense, you were able to redate some of the oldest structures on the planet to points that most mainstream scientists don't, or and anthropologists don't, think there was civilization. Is that fair to say about you?
I think that's very fair to say. To make a long story short, the classic, and I'm an academic, so just for the readers that are, listeners that don't know about me, I teach at Boston University. I've taught there for, over 30 years, full-time faculty member, PhD, Yale University in geology and geophysics. But I became interested in ancient civilizations. Actually, I was always interested in them, but my work in them really began when I got together, collaborate with the late John Anthony West, who I think we'll talk about in the, maybe, you know, in the next hour.
Yeah.
We collaborated together, I as a geologist and scientist, and to tie in with what you were just saying, the standard academic view, which still holds sway in most universities and conventional settings, is that civilization began a mere 5,000 to 6,000 years ago. What I've been able to demonstrate first with the Sphinx, the Great Sphinx in Egypt, and also with other sites now, is that there was what I refer to as an earlier cycle of civilization that goes back to at least about 10,000 plus BC. So really more than twice as old as the conventional concept of the beginning of civilization, that this earlier, quite sophisticated, and I believe important civilization, in the sense that they probably knew things we don't know, was demolished, was devastated at the end of the last ice age by the catastrophes at the end of the last ice age.
Yes, I want to talk about the ice age. I mean, that is key, and of course it might be key to our future as well. But let's just talk about John West, and he was called by many people a renegade Egyptologist, and he had his own unique ideas, and this was influenced by the reading of the Temple of Man by Shlomo de Lubitz. And somewhere, I don't know where in the Temple of Man, it says that there is water erosion on the Sphinx. Is that correct orientation?
Yeah, that's basically correct. To elaborate on that, John Anthony West, who was a very, very close friend as well as a colleague, we first met each other back in the late 1980s, or became friends almost immediately, I'll put it that way, also collaborated research together. So I knew him about 30 years. He passed away just last month, February 6th, unfortunately, from, you know, horrible case of cancer and fighting that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he wasn't a young man. He was 85. Mm-hmm. But getting back to the importance of his work, he was not an Egyptologist in a classic traditional academic sense. That is, he had no degrees in Egyptology, but he had studied it extensively on his own over decades and decades, wrote about it. This really began with his work on astrology and then tying it in with the stars, and that led him to Egypt. It led him to the work of Shlomo de Lubitz, who you mentioned. And Shlomo de Lubitz was really what's referred to as symbolist Egypt. And one of the main tenets of symbolist Egypt is that the Egyptians were not these primitive, you know, people that Egyptologists, conventional Egyptologists, tend to make them out to be.
Worshipping animals.
Yeah, worshipping animals, worshipping a number of gods with human bodies and animal heads. And the Egyptologists, and I thought this was just crazy when before I start dealing with the Egyptologists, they will snicker about how stupid and primitive the ancient Egyptians were, even as they devote their life to studying them. It's almost ironic.
And even after they can't even duplicate the building of something like the Great Pyramid. That is
exactly.
Not, they can't figure out how they're able to build that, yet they want to make fun of their primitive belief system, which actually wasn't primitive. Of course, John was so funny. He would call the academics quackademics.
Quackademics,
you know?
Exactly. That was one of his favorite terms. And, you're absolutely spot on there. They would make fun of the ancient Egyptians and their primitive belief systems. And really what it comes down to, and John West, unfortunately, is gone, but I'll speak for him because I think he would say something to this effect only in his own version of it. The ancient Egyptians weren't primitive at all. It's us, or at least the Egyptologists, that don't understand what they were saying, how they were speaking. They don't understand the metaphors that were used, the symbolism that was used. That's why it's sometimes called the symbolist school of Egypt. And so to give an analogy, West would sometimes say this. I always called John Anthony West, and he called me Shock.
Okay.
So if I refer to West, that's who I'm talking about. West would make the good analogy that everyone knows about Jesus Christ. Jesus would tell parables, and he would talk about shepherds and sheep and farmers and sowing and reaping. Well, he wasn't giving agricultural advice. He was giving deep spiritual advice.
That's
and
funny.
Essentially the ancient Egyptian texts, some of them, you can translate them, and you can even argue whether the translations are good or not, but you can translate them in a very trivial sense versus really looking deep into what were they saying at the most fundamental level, if that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense. And that gives us such a foundation for Western civilization because, you know, of course, the Greeks and the Romans and even the Hebrew, every aspect of what we call Western civilization was influenced by Egyptian thinking.
By Egypt. I mean, the Greeks were very clear about that. They learned from the ancient Egyptians. Pythagoras and Plato, all of them talked about that. The story of Atlantis came from Egypt. We can bring up Atlantis later if you're interested.
No, I do want to bring
Judaism,
up because
of course, is I think West would sometimes say something like Judaism is Egyptian religion on the run or something like that.
And of course, the whole Christian mass,
energy.
The whole Christian mass itself, the whole Roman Catholic mass is really an Egyptian ceremony with the frankincense and the high hat and the altar. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the Ark is Egyptian. The concept of a manger and the cradle and Jesus and the Virgin Mary. Well, you've got Horus and Isis and you've got Osiris. You've got the Trinity. It's all Egyptian. And historically, it's not surprising that where did Christianity take hold very, very, very early on in Egypt? Because it's essentially Egyptian religion transformed into a slightly different version.
That is interesting. That, yeah. So, I mean, everything we owe to the Egyptians. But I do want to get back to John a little bit because he was such a huge influence in this field. And the book you talked about that he wrote about astrology was called The Case for Astrology.
Correct.
And where he first says, well, you know, there really is something to, you know, different times of year, different effects of the stars on consciousness. I mean, he was
Actually, the strongest case when you read the case for astrology, and he's reviewing other work, et cetera, but a very, very strong case that in particular planetary positions relative to each other have a huge impact. And he would often use the concept of a symphony. I'm trying to say symphony, although we could be sympathetic to the star, symphony that of the cosmos, and that reflects on Earth and vice versa. And this, of course, goes back to the ancient, sometimes said to be Hermetic, but the Hermetic sayings go back to Egypt, as above, so below.
So, John, you met John in the late 1980s, and this evolved into a television show on NBC called The Mystery of the Sphinx that my friends Bill Cody and John Cheshire, or Saeed, they all helped produce this really major show narrated by Charlton Heston. It's still an influential show if you watch it, and still revolutionary in a sense. But how did you meet John initially, and how did he get you involved in this, and what were your feelings when he first told you about this? So how did you meet John first?
Okay, so the way I met John was a planned accident. I'll put it that way. That's maybe unfair to say. There was a faculty member at Boston University, again, this is late 1980s, who had taught. He was an English professor. He had taught at American University in Cairo, had met John West when he was leading some of his tours to Egypt, that type of thing. They'd been talking about it. This faculty member was fascinated by, this eccentric, we'll call him rogue Egyptologist, as he called himself, that had these fascinating ideas, and essentially said to John West, well, is there anything I could do to help you? And apparently West had said, find me an open-minded geologist, because West knew at that time that it really would take geological expertise to look at the Sphinx specifically, look at the weathering pattern, see if it really was water erosion, what would the implications of that be, more or less, if it was water erosion, did that then mean it had to go back to pre-Sahara times, which would get into, the early dating. So apparently this faculty member had kept this in mind for several years. He ended up teaching not only at Boston University, but at the very college where I have been teaching, since 1984, might as well have real dates. And that faculty member and I got to know each other. We were in good, friendly terms. And that faculty member was able to get John West invited to a colloquium, a symposium. It was just one of these things that was, that universities often will invite someone if they're relatively local, because John Anthony West lived in upstate New York, to come and give a seminar for the students and faculty. And it was a Friday afternoon type of event where people just get together, somewhat socialize, also learn something new. So this was arranged, and it was arranged that I would make sure I would be there so I could see John Anthony West and they could see what my reaction was. And we had dinner afterwards at the home of this other faculty member, and we got to talking, and John Anthony West seemed like an interesting fellow, and we sort of got along right away, which was interesting. And he went my opinion, and I said, well, yeah, from the slides he was showing me, it looks interesting. It could be water weathering, and that would have major implications for the dating because it would have to be pre-Sahara, blah, blah, blah. But, I said, I can't really tell from a bunch of photographs. I know I'm a professional geologist. I know that people can have photographs and it looks like one thing, but then when you're there on site, you put everything into context and a different story emerges. And I also probably told him at the time that, all my academic colleagues in Egyptology, they agree that the Sphinx is about 2500 BC. I mean, I didn't think this was a big controversy. Of course, they were all giving the standard dogma. And where we left it was that, you know, I wasn't going to say anything or worry about this further. And I told him, you know, I'd really have to go to Egypt to inspect the rocks and really make sense out of it. And he said, oh, yeah, well, you know, we'll see, work on that. And I didn't believe him for a second, you know, that all of a sudden he was going to arrange for me to go to Egypt. But lo and behold, summer of 1990 comes around and he invites me to go to Egypt with him and do a first reconnaissance inspection on site, and everything blossomed from there.
Wait, were you just a pretty normal, regular geologist up until that point? Did you ever ancient civilization?
Well, it depends on what you call a normal, regular geologist. I have a degree in geology and geophysics from Yale. That's where my PhD is. Actually, I have 3 degrees from Yale. I'm not trying to say I have a bunch of degrees, but I'm stressing I am a normal academic. I didn't, you know, I'm not a self-taught geologist like West was a self-taught Egyptologist. I have all the proper academic credentials if people worry about the such things. And, yeah, I was doing normal standard geology. My specialty, if it means anything to your listeners, was Eocene stratigraphy. Now, it just so happened that Sphinx is carved out of Eocene rocks, Eocene limestone, so I could sort of justify in a normal sense, oh, I'd like to see these rocks. I even joked with West on my first trip that, you know, these are really beautiful Eocene limestones. It shows reefal structures and all this type of thing and little fossils. Too bad that they chopped it all up and carved into the silly statue. But he didn't appreciate
that.
I said that to him, you know, as a joke.
Right. A normal geologist wouldn't look at sculptures necessarily. I mean, a geologist.
Exactly.
A normal
geologist would not look at sculptures. But I wanted to add something. And this probably ties in with my receptivity. I was always interested in ancient cultures, ancient civilizations. I remember when I was just a few years old going to see Tutankhamun's, some treasures from Tutankhamun that had been brought to Washington, D.C. for an exhibition. I remember my grandmother, you know, giving me books on ancient history. My grandmother was a theosophist. So, and she taught me a lot about theosophy, which is not exactly mainstream academia. So I think in hindsight, as I reflect on myself, I had been prepared, it turns out, to look at certain things, and I want to say objectively, and looking at the real evidence, but also keeping an open mind and realizing that there's sometimes academia might be wrong.
Was that true of anything you had seen before you saw the Sphinx, that there was a big error in some kind of academic issue? Did you ever notice that before?
Oh, before I got involved in the Sphinx, you mean different types of subjects?
Was there any way you saw that academia was totally off before you got to the Sphinx?
Actually, I'll tell you a couple of stories. One, personally, I worked as a graduate student. I worked on various types of fossil mammals. I actually have one named after me. But I worked on different types of fossil mammals. And in some cases, you know, we would be reconstructing the relationships of the mammals and how they relate to each other. And in a couple of cases, I found that when I looked at all the evidence, the standard reconstructions were frankly wrong. And I was able to convince my colleagues that we had to look at things very, very differently. I'll give you 2 other examples. I remember when the asteroid hypothesis for the extinction of the dinosaurs was first proposed. I was a young, you know, graduate student or so at the time. And I remember that it was first proposed by Alvarez et al. This is the extinction of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, which had always been a geological problem. And I remember very specifically professors at the time laughing at it and saying this was absurd, this was ridiculous, you know, nothing like this happens. I mean, little comets and asteroids might hit, but nothing that's going to be so devastating, worldwide catastrophe. Well, all these decades later, we have so much evidence to demonstrate that that is the case. It has now become the mainstream thought.
Right. I wonder what was it that was discovered, and of course we want to get into your whole theory about these asteroids, but what was it that convinced the mainstream that it was a huge meteorite or asteroid, right, that hit the Earth, that destroyed the dinosaur population?
Oh, well, they found a crater. They found all kinds of stratigraphic evidence. I mean, one thing you want when you put together something scientific like this is that all the different pieces of the puzzle have to fit together. So generally, it's not even just one, quote, smoking gun, as some people like to use the term, and I hate that term personally, but it's a lot of different evidence that has to come together that all complements each other, and that has happened with the asteroid impact. We have iridium layers around the world from the asteroid. We have fragments of the asteroid in the Yucatan area. The actual crater has been found. It's now covered with 65 million years worth of sediment, but you can pick it up geophysically. The extinctions and what caused the extinctions due to climatic change is all explained by asteroid. It's a very, very interesting situation where most people in the scientific community, geologists in particular, thought that it was not the case. They thought it was ridiculous. I was told by one faculty member, again, I was a student at the time, that the only reason it was published is because one of the co-authors on it had won the Nobel Prize in Physics, but frankly, he knew nothing about geology, and they just felt that they had to let him publish it because he had won a Nobel Prize in a different discipline. But, you know, everyone would forget about the theory by a week or two, and it would be gone. So, you know, it's an interesting type of thing. I think this is going to be the case for the Sphinx and the redating of the Sphinx.
Absolutely. But I'm just curious a little bit about a little more specifics of that asteroid. So there's an asteroid at a certain size that did what? How big was it? And it happened about 65. And how did that kill probably hundreds of thousands or maybe millions of creatures on the planet? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, it was huge. I forget honestly what the estimated size of it was, but it was a huge asteroid. I forget now. I mean, I didn't think we were going to talk about this that much, but you know, it left hundreds of kilometers in diameter, just the crater. It would have thrown up a huge debris cloud and dust cloud, caused huge climatic changes. You had iridium around. It may have caused levels of radioactivity. This is me speculating. It certainly impacted the oxygen levels in the atmosphere. And when you've got something that big, it's going to be absolutely global. It's actually a good analogy, although a very different type of thing, but somewhat analogous, I'm using it as a crude analogy, for what happened at the end of the last ice age, 9700 BC, but at the end of the last ice age, it was not an asteroid or comet that hit, it was solar eruptions that caused atmospheric changes, climatic changes, disrupted our magnetosphere, disrupted the atmosphere, caused high radiation levels on the surface of the Earth. So when you have things that are big enough like that, geologically and astronomically, they will have global ramifications. For instance, a lot of animals went extinct. Now I'm going back to the Cretaceous now, 65 million years ago. A lot went extinct in the oceans, probably because of the ocean chemistry changing. And a lot of marine organisms are very sensitive to the ocean chemistry and also temperatures. So even in modern times, we see reefs dying because of very minor temperature changes. But when you have a major temperature change like that, a lot of species are very vulnerable. Likewise on land, when you have temperature changes or oxygen changes in the level of oxygen, etc. So the dinosaurs went extinct, except for the birds. The birds, frankly, are, from a taxonomic point of view, little feathered dinosaurs.
They are. The birds evolved out of reptilians.
I'm sorry?
The birds evolved out of reptilians.
In fact, it's now, there's plenty of evidence now that a lot of the, what we think of as genuine dinosaurs, were covered with feathers too. They had plumage. There's evidence that they had plumage, that they were brightly covered. So you can think of Tyrannosaurus rex running around but having little feathers rather than scales.
Wow. All right. So that sort of gives a nice – but there were no humans alive at that point, were
there? No. Humans didn't come around for another – you know, humans have only been around, depending on how you define human – humans have only been around the last couple of million years. Our species only goes back maybe 200,000 years or so.
Or so they say. That's not an idea.
Or so
that,
they
that's
say.
The
well,
academic.
Well, that, yeah, yeah, I know. I mean, I know the evidence otherwise. But what you have to also look at is not just humans, but, and this gets back to one of my themes, were there earlier cycles of, we'll call it beings, that were technologically sophisticated. So in some cases, people will find things, and I don't want to get into it. Well, we could always get into it, but there's so many different digressions we could talk about. This is why people need to come to the October conference. We can talk about all this.
Read your book as well, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Forgotten Civilization is a good book to read, my book, Forgotten Civilization. Subtitle, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. And if I could put a plug for my website.
Please.
www.robertschoch.com. So www.robertschoch, all one word, and schoch is schoch.com. But I was going to say is even if you find sophisticated evidence of artificiality, you know, you have to then decide, is that human or not? How do you define human? Depending on how you define human, it may be, you know, there have been other, quote, species of humans on Earth in the past. So it gets, you know, it gets complicated.
Right. But I want to get back. Thank you for that little digression. But I want to get back to joining John West for that first time in Egypt, because essentially – the two of you are essentially, you changed history. You changed the dating of civilization. Well, yes, it's a huge thing, and congratulations for being willing to step out there against the academic thinking and say, no, there's something else going on here. So you go to Egypt. So talk about that back in the late 1990 with John West, and he had read in the Temple of Man that there were water weatherings, and he brought you over there to see, is this really water weathering? Talk about that first time you were at the Sphinx, okay?
Well, first time, yeah. We go over in 1990, and I see the Sphinx for the first time, and this happened within 30 seconds of seeing the Sphinx. Two things struck me very quickly as a geologist. One was that, yes, this sure looks like water weathering. It sure looks like very ancient water weathering. I even mumbled something under my breath, which I asked him never to repeat. And, of course, he loved to repeat it afterwards. You know, he held back for a couple of years. And I'll say it now. I said not only did something to the effect that, I mean, you know, this looks like it could be referring to the weathering. This looks like it could be 100,000 years old, which I don't want to say. I believe it's 100,000 years old. But the point was that it's extremely weathered, that has to go back to an earlier pre-Sahara condition. Initially, I was thinking 5,000 to 7,000 BC and that was a very, very conservative view. I'm now absolutely convinced it's at least 10,000 to 11,000 BC, and I talk about that in Origins of the Sphinx, which is a book that I wrote with my colleague Robert Bouval that just came out last year. And again, that's at www.robertshock.com. But getting back to John Anthony West, the first thing that struck me was on our first trip there, literally within 30 seconds or so of seeing the Sphinx for the first time, was that, yes, there's something to this. And I was absolutely perplexed because, you know, where were the Egyptologists? How could they have missed this? And I kept thinking to myself that there had to be something wrong here. And I also realized that this was not flooding. This was not water coming up from the Nile. If it had been doing that, it would have been undercutting considerably. It would not be what we see. Many people have said to me, well, you know, it's just Nile flooding. Well, no, it's not Nile flooding, and it's not Nile flooding covering the entire body of the Sphinx and up the enclosure walls. I mean, sometimes people say silly things and they've never actually been there, or even if they've been there, they haven't actually looked at it carefully. I realized that was water coming down from above, more or less precipitation, rainfall, runoff, which we now know goes back to the end of the last ice age from the solar outburst that put all this water into the atmosphere that had to come down as torrential rains. So number one was I recognized the water weathering. Number two, immediately I said to myself, and I think I said to John Anthony West, the head is too small for the body. And furthermore, the head is not weathered the same way as the body. And it was quite evident to me initially, and I'll speak as a scientist, my working hypothesis within 30 or so seconds was that that was not the original head of the Sphinx, that is a recarved head. They recarved it, and it became smaller. That's why it doesn't look the same as the body. It doesn't, well, I'm talking geologically, it doesn't have the same weathering. And yes, no question in my mind at that time that it was a dynastic head. And yeah, sure, okay, it's a dynastic head. That could be 2500 BC. But that doesn't mean that the Sphinx originally in 2500 BC. It just means it was reused. It was reappropriated. The head was probably heavily, heavily weathered. And they recarved it to look the way it does now, more or less. They recarved into a human head. I always was a lion originally.
Oh, wait, so you're saying it hasn't been a new head that's been placed on this thing. There was a head that was then reformatted from the head that was there.
Correct. Absolutely correct.
I never knew that. Okay.
Yeah,
yes.
No. And this is a very important point because that is all solid bedrock. There's no question in my mind, and I've actually walked on the back of the Sphinx. I had the privilege to do that. I've looked at it up close. When you look at the head now, you'll see that there's cement on it. They've mucked about with it, to use a non-technical term. And if people want to go to Origins of the Sphinx, the book I wrote with Robert Bouval, they will find lots of photographs from before the 1920s, when they had, before had the modern restorations. But there's no doubt that head is contiguous with the body. It's all solid rock. And what happened was that the original head, which I believe was a lion, in fact, a female lion, Mehet, and if people go to my website, they'll find a recent article that I wrote with Dr. Manu Saifzadeh and Robert Bouval. We wrote an article talking about what the original Sphinx was, a lioness. But that original head was highly eroded, weathered from the rains, from the precipitation, and instead of trying to repair it as they did to the body with little blocks of limestone, and you can see those on the paws of the Sphinx in particular, they did something that's just as logical in hindsight. They simply took the rotted, eroded head and recarved it. When you recarve something, it gets smaller.
And was it true that it was Napoleon's soldiers that blasted the nose off?
No.
Not at all.
In fact, Napoleon was very, very interested in antiquities. He would have had, I suspect he would have had any soldiers that did something like that summarily executed. Actually, I'm serious. Actually, it apparently was Arabs earlier, because Egypt was not originally Arab. The Arabs came and invaded the country and
population is a whole different race than the Arab population.
Exactly.
People can
relate to this in America, or at least if they think about it. The typical, I hate to say it, there's a lot of typical Americans who are not Native American, but they're considered typical Americans now. They're either European ancestry or Hispanic ancestry or Asian ancestry or African ancestry. So we've got a lot of Americans now that are not, from the Native North American population. And the same in Egypt. But in Egypt, this has been going on. The Arabs invaded Egypt well over 1,000 years ago, and apparently it was some of the Arabs who weren't so fond of the Sphinx, or at least didn't care about it, who used it as target practice, cannon practice. Or maybe even did it purposefully, because you'll notice when you look at the face of the Sphinx, what is most damaged, that's the nose, and you take the nose off of a statue to kill its spirit.
Oh, really?
So it's not, sometimes people don't realize this. Noses are fragile anyway on statues. But in some cases, on ancient statues, you'll see that they consistently lose their nose. Well, sometimes that's purposeful, because it's a way to, quote, kill the statue, if you would.
Kill the energy of the statue.
Kill the energy of it. Kill the spirit of it.
Just about the difference between Egyptians and Arabs, they have different features. You can still see some of the original, when I was in Egypt, I could see some of the original Egyptian features where they have eyes that are wider set apart.
Exactly.
There's still elements of that.
Exactly. And when I take people to Egypt, and I do, and if people are interested in going to Egypt, I'm planning a trip late May 2019.
And how could they sign up for that?
I haven't posted it yet, but the best thing to do is go to my website, and they'll find under contact my email address, info@robertshock.com. They can send me an email and say they're interested, because right now I'm planning it with my colleagues in Egypt, so we're pricing it out, getting it all together. So it hasn't been posted yet. Once it's all finalized, it'll be posted on my website. But in the meantime, I would encourage people to actually send me an email. Go to the website, go to contact. They'll find my email address there and let me know that they're interested, because I've already got quite a number of people interested in it. I hate to put it this way, I'll just say it bluntly. John West was always blunt, and he didn't mind people being blunt. He used to give wonderful trips. He used to take people to Egypt also, and I've been doing it a long time too. He and I would do it independently. We'd do it together. But because of his cancer, he could not do his last trip. This was in February, March last year. I got to get that right. That was his last scheduled trip. There had already been a lot of people that signed up for it, and he just couldn't do it. I mean, he's in the hospital in critical situation. Right. So I actually did it gratis. I did it on his behalf. I ended up leading the last, and it was meaningful to me as my close friend. I wanted to do it for him. I ended up leading the last John Anthony West trip. So a number of people have said to me that, it was on their bucket list to get to Egypt. So, we're putting together more.
Whoever you go with,
but I was
amazing,
getting back to a point, actually. Yeah. When I take people to Egypt, you can see the difference as you go from Cairo and as we go south into Upper Egypt. You can see the change in the population, and you tend to have more of the we'll saw classic, you know, native Egyptian features as you go south.
Oh, I see. But there was one geological question I've always been interested in, because if you claim, and I'm sure you're right, that the Sphinx was created while it was still, while it wasn't desert, it means that there was a jungle type of forested.
Well, I don't know if it was jungle. I would say more temperate. Yeah,
like what would it be compared to, like upstate New York or that kind of, like, not exactly.
Well, not with all the cities. Yeah, yeah. I
no, but it's more
say.
Tropical.
Yeah, yeah, it's maybe you know, forested area, that type of thing, with a lot of animals and game. What?
There were lots of lions, and lions were very popular
in
that part of the world.
Yes, absolutely.
Of course,
there are a lot of
now.
Lions and gazelles and things like that. Yeah, it would have been very abundant plant and animals.
And so the land there, because if you go there now, it looks like, you know, it's all desert, all sand.
Yeah.
And the sand around it is very much looks like the sand or the struck of the rock of the Sphinx itself. So you're saying there was like a level of like topsoil where the vegetation grew, and then underneath that there was a like a huge rock formation that the Sphinx was carved out of. Is that what
you're thinking?
Yeah,
I mean, they would have carved, because you have high areas. The Giza Plateau is a plateau geologically, so there was probably rock. You know, you can think of an area in the modern times where you have a rock outlier. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice.
Sure.
A rock outlier or, you know, you have rock. It's not a mountain per se, but, you know, a good chunk of rock that's exposed. And they probably were attracted to this. There was probably the head of the Sphinx. We were talking about the head of the Sphinx. Was probably a rock outcropping at the time. And my hypothesis, and actually I'm not alone in this, some Egyptologists have even said this, although they put the dating a little differently, of course, that probably originally the Sphinx started as a big rock outcropping sitting above the general soil level, as you said, and attached, of course, to the bedrock, and that they probably started by carving it into a head. It may have originally looked sort of like a face or something, and then they carved it into a head, I believe a lion's head initially, and then they continued to work on it and, you know, dig out the soil and get down to the bedrock and carve into the rock. You know, think of a quarry, essentially, and carve the body out. And I say think of a quarry because they realized this was nice rock, and they actually quarried out huge blocks when they carved the body of the Sphinx, took those just to the east of the Sphinx to build what's called nowadays the Sphinx Temple, which sits to this day right in front of the Sphinx. So they realized there was rock there. They probably started by having this rock outcrop into a head, and then they took it from there, and the rest is history, as they say. Now, since then, with the Sahara moving in, that you had desertification, more or less, you know, desert forming, you strip off the topsoil, you start getting sand, etc. These are just natural things that happen, and they're happening to this day. You can see that type of those types of changes taking place even in, say, the last 200 years in many areas.
So what was the dating from when it went from temperate, you know, topsoil to desert? What is that official date or your date?
The official date, well, it depends on who you're talking to. There's a couple of official dates. One is a dramatic, dramatic climate change at 9700 BC, which I've mentioned already, which is the end of the last ice age. We can date that very precisely based on ice cores and isotopic records in the ice cores and various sediment cores. I talk about this in my book, Forgotten Civilization. So that's number one. There was a major change then, which would have affected the Sphinx, or we can even call it the proto-Sphinx, because it goes back to that earlier civilization. And from that time on, you have major changes in climate. You have climate going back and forth, you know, sometimes more moist, sometimes less moist. And then the other major sort of official date is about 5,000 years ago, about 3,000 BC, when it's very well documented that you have the ultra hyper arid desert conditions have set in by then. And that's really the dating of the modern Sahara. So you've got 3,000 BC, dating of the modern Sahara, and then going back in time, about 9,700 BC, the dating of the last ice age. And in between those two dates, you had fluctuations in climate back and forth. But there's no doubt in my mind that at this point, for numerous reasons, which again I get into detail in Origins of the Sphinx for those who are interested, that the Sphinx itself, the original Sphinx, goes back to that really early period before the end of the last ice age, before 9700 BC.
So the Sphinx was originally carved from that one piece of stone sometime before 9700 BC,
correct.
2000 BC.
Correct. Okay. And what we talk about, and this ties in, which is why Robert Bouval and I wrote the book together, this ties in with what the ancient Egyptians themselves talked about, which was Zeptepi, the first time, the primordial time, if you would. They called it Zeptepi. We can now date that back to approximately, I'll use Bouval's archaeoastronomy here, approximately 10,500 BC, when all the correlations line up. That lines up with prior to the end of the last ice age. That lines up to the geological evidence, as I now best interpret it, for the age of the Sphinx. That has to be at least that old. It probably goes back even a bit further. So everything lines up that it goes back to that early period. This also ties in with things, for instance, like the dating of Atlantis according to Plato. And here I take Atlantis not as a geographic region. And I agree with West on this, John Anthony West, because he called it the A word, didn't he? I called it the A word. For years, yes. West was upset that I would not say the word Atlantis, at least not on camera.
Right.
Or in radio interviews.
Right.
Because, you know, to this day, if you talk about Atlantis in standard academia, they start laughing at you and thinking you're crazy unless you're a philosopher and you're just using it as a metaphor or analogy. But the way I'm using Atlantis and the way John Anthony West used Atlantis, and I believe the way Plato used Atlantis, is not so much worried about where's the geographic location. We can talk about that, but really what's important is that the dating of Atlantis goes back to what we now call the end of the last ice age. Plato put it about 9600 BC. Modern dating puts it at 9700 BC. But the point is that there was sophisticated civilization at that early period. And I just wanted to make one other quick point. We have independent evidence now at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey that there's also incredible sophistication before 9700 BC, and that it was there. We have the same story of that civilization being devastated, and we have, you know, evidence of it at Göbekli Tepe as well as in Egypt of the catastrophes at that time.
But wait, let me just get something clear. If you say, and I believe you, that the Sphinx was probably built, at least maybe, let's give it a rough estimate, 10,000 years B.C., and the water weathering didn't happen to when did the weathering happen?
The weathering began at the end of the last ice age. Probably the majority of the water weathering on the Sphinx, this is me speaking now, mm-hmm. If you look at my papers from decades ago, I've refined my thinking on this. Probably the major water weathering on the Sphinx is 9700 BC or thereabouts, at the end of the last ice age, because that's when we had, and we now know this geologically, torrential rains and water runoff, and it would have had a huge impact on the Sphinx. Again, to put it in context, you have a major solar outburst, you have a huge climate change, a huge dramatic warming, you're melting the glaciers, you're putting all kinds of water into the atmosphere, you're literally melting not just glaciers, but lakes are evaporating very, very quickly. The atmosphere can only hold so much water before it starts precipitating out again. So this is a time geologically when we have recorded absolutely torrential rains. I personally think it goes back to the Bible and all the stories around the world of huge flooding. And I think that the majority, or at least the initial impact on the Sphinx, was from that period. Now, did it weather more since then? Of course. And is it still weathering today because of Cairo pollution and whatnot? Yes, of course.
It would have had to be even much older than 97,000 for it to...
9,700.
9,700, I mean, it could be, like you initially said, it could be 20,000 or 50,000.
Okay. Yeah, I see where you're going. I'm giving it still a minimal date. Let me rephrase it. I'm saying the Sphinx was there in 10,000 BC.
Right.
Could it be older? I can't deny it could be older. And coming back to John Anthony West, something that he used to like to goad me about, and I can't say he was wrong, absolutely, he often said, well, the Sphinx itself could be a precessional cycle earlier, because there are astronomical alignments that make sense. In 10,000 BC or thereabouts, the Sphinx is looking at its own image in the sky on the vernal equinox, more or less Leo.
Leo.
Exactly. Now that happened
Leo 10,000 years ago. Yes. Okay.
Yes, but that also happens 36,000 BC or thereabouts, more or less a precessional cycle earlier. And West and I would often have these long discussions. Could the Sphinx actually go back to that even earlier period, an earlier cycle, so tens of thousands of years earlier? Could I deny that geologically? Absolutely no. And one of the interesting things is that once you get a weathering profile at a certain, that distinctive diagnostic feature, it can remain relatively stable for a very long time. More or less, the rock continues to weather and recede, but it keeps the same profile, if that makes sense to you and the listeners. So I'm saying it's at least 10,000 BC. I'm not saying it's any older than that, but I'm also saying that I have to be open to the possibility, if we have evidence in the future, that maybe it is older. What I've got right now doesn't preclude the possibility.
No, it's fascinating. I think you're so instrumental in the whole field of geoarchaeology. But the main thing I think we should talk about, I don't know how much time we have, but the thing is about the Ice Age. Can you run through the climate? So before there was an ice age, how far back does that go, and what precipitated the ice age and what ended the ice age? So let's start before the ice age. When was that?
Okay, well, yeah, this gets very complex, but we'll do a simple version. Argue about what causes ice ages to begin and end, because there have been a number of ice ages over the last couple of million years. You probably have to have the Earth in the right position, both astronomically and also continental positions. Continents change, that type of thing. It ties in with ocean circulation patterns. So the Earth does not always go in and out of ice ages. But in geologic terms, it does periodically go through periods where you have periods within those periods of ice ages. We happen to live in one of those periods.
We're in a period
of ice ages. We're probably what's known as an interglacial at the moment, and we may, frankly, be going into another ice age. So to get back to your question, what drives the climate fluctuations during periods when you can have ice ages? And you generally have an ice age for maybe 100,000 years, and you have an interglacial or a period between ice ages, maybe 10,000 plus years. And if you think of it that terms, it's been 12,000 years since the last ice age, quote, ended. We're due for another ice age. But, you know, that's very imprecise.
I also want to know how you define ice age. So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, ice age, people argue about that, but ice age is essentially a period of overall climatic cooling on Earth. It's generally, most of the work has been done in the northern hemisphere, but, you know, you have overall climatic differences in temperature, you know, cooling temperatures, numerous degrees below what we have now. So let me talk about the very end of the last ice age, then that might help clarify things. At the very end of the last ice age, it was starting to get warmer. A lot of the temperature changes probably have to do with solar variation, changes in the sun. There's a very strong correlation between sunspots, sun cycles, not just 11-year cycles, but longer-term cycles. And again, I talk about this in Forgotten Civilization. And temperatures on Earth, this is something that people tend to deny because right now it's very popular to blame everything on humans. But, you know, there's been climatic changes long before humans were around, and they correlate with solar changes that we can pick up with isotope data in ice cores and sediment cores. So a lot of it seems to be driven by the sun. At the end of the last ice age, toward the end, there's what's known as the Younger Dryas. So the Earth was slowly warming up until about 10,900, 10,800 BC, suddenly it was driven back into really cold temperatures that had not existed for, back to the colder temperatures of the Ice Age. It had started to warm up. It was driven back into the height of the Ice Age, if you would. And that lasted about 1,200 years or so. And then suddenly, within just a few days, maybe literally overnight, and this is based on isotope data, so it's not just me saying this, the suddenly and dramatically warmed up to essentially modern temperatures, you know, probably literally overnight. And that would make sense because it was probably an outburst from the sun that essentially scorched or fried the Earth.
This was 10,000 years ago or 9,700
BC. So the two dates are 10,900 BC, beginning of the Younger Dryas, where you have a cooling event. And that is the one, and I hate to bring it up because there's no evidence for it, but some people claim there was a comet then. There's actually no evidence for that, and I don't want to...
This is Graham Hancock's theory.
Yeah, but he's misinterpreted... He's essentially cited a lot of evidence that has been falsified in the academic community.
We'll maybe have you two debate each other at the Portal to Ascension conference.
No, I don't think it's worth it, frankly.
There's more important
things to talk about. But I just want to say that I don't accept that that thesis. And in fact, there's lots of evidence that the sun was having erratic behavior at that time. That's what drove the cool period. And then it exploded the sun in 9700 BC. And that's what essentially snapped us out of the last ice age. All the evidence
But humans.
I'm sorry?
All the evidence is, though. No, I'm just
all the evidence is solar, or that the sun was driving this.
I understand. But do you humans can exist through these cycles of ice age, right?
They can flourish. They can flourish. You look at the Neanderthals, for instance, who are a species of human. They did very, very well during the Ice Age. They probably went extinct in part because of climatic changes, and all of a sudden it was frankly too hot for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on what you're used to.
But, okay, going back to that event, 9,700 years ago, something warmed the Earth, like maybe practically overnight, and that started the precipitation that is then the flooding? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. Because, okay, so, I mean, the something specifically, I'm absolutely convinced based on the evidence, was a solar outburst. You would have had, in some places, essentially what looked like huge lightning strikes hitting the Earth, what's known as plasma or electrically charged particles from a coronal mass ejection that apparently hit the Earth at the time. We have modern analogies for this. For instance, the Carrington event in 1859, which was very, very, very minor, but fried the telegraph lines at the time. So you can think of, you know, really dramatic changes. It would have correlated or did correlate with earthquake activity, with volcanic activity. As I said, you can think of, just for a visual, huge lightning striking the Earth in certain spots, sort of like tornadoes hitting down is an analogy, frying things. We actually have evidence of vitrification, rock having flash melted and then re-solidified. Whenever you hit water, whether the water was ice or liquid water, it would have evaporated almost immediately, effectively, from these very high temperatures. And it would have put a lot of moisture into the atmosphere, as I mentioned, which cannot be sustained, and it comes out as torrential rains. I also wanted to mention that some of the evidence that's been suggested for a comet, since we did bring it up, are things, for instance, like vitrification, what they call shocked quartz, different types of nanodiamonds, et cetera. It's now been demonstrated that even conventional lightning, even conventional lightning can produce such effects. Now, when you have a sun, the solar event, a solar outburst, and you have this on a massive scale worldwide, you get those types of features. So what I'm saying, very simply, is a lot of the evidence that's been used to support a comet actually is compatible with and even makes more sense with a solar outburst. So I'm convinced that's what happened, and that's what caused these torrential rains, et cetera. Now, getting to the area of the Sphinx, during the end of the last ice age, that's a relatively low latitude, so it wasn't super cold at all. It was really wonderful for people to live there. Now, frankly, Egypt's a bit on the hot side, should we say.
Even in the Ice Age, it was a good place to live.
Oh, it was a wonderful place to live. I wish I lived there during the end of the last Ice Age.
Maybe you did.
Yeah, maybe I did. Because this is another misconception some people have. They think, oh, Ice Age, that the whole world was cold and horrible. No. I mean, there were latitudinal gradients just as there are today. And places like what's modern Sahara Desert was really nice. That's where you wanted to hang out, et cetera.
But the torrential rains, was that a worldwide phenomenon, every continent?
Yes.
And how did that affect the oceans and everything?
Oh,
like that
was a worldwide phenomenon. So you had flooding, you had lakes rising, you have, of course, myths and stories about floods around the world. But it also affected the oceans. The oceans were affected a couple of different ways. Of course, anything that falls on land ultimately works its way to the oceans. And when you have torrential rains, this ties in with something else we were talking about before. You strip topsoil. You know, you have a lot of erosion, not just on the Sphinx, but more generally. So it would have been quite horrific from that point of view. You have all this water making its way into the ocean. And, of course, the glaciers melting, all ended up in the ocean. So all this huge mass of water going into the oceans raised sea levels by hundreds of meters, and that's well documented geologically. Furthermore, when you warm the oceans, which is what happened, warm water expands. The water expands a little bit. So just from thermal expansion, you raise sea levels on top of, you know, in addition to the water that you're adding to it. So it really was, a lot of things were happening. And of course, most people historically and to this day live near coastal areas.
Mm-hmm.
People like the beach, and they like the beach mm-hmm. 20,000 years ago. But not a good place to be when sea levels are rising quickly and dramatically.
Well, that really brings us to the most important thing. I mean, it's great to talk about the past, but what is happening now? Is it possible that something like that, like a solar event or an ice age, or can happen or will happen?
Yeah, it's not just possible. I think it's absolutely, it's not even just probable. It will happen. I mean,
what
I'm a geologist.
Happen?
Let's be realistic. These things happen. And
what
the
exactly
sun
is going, yeah.
What?
What exactly you think is going to happen?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, the sun is a star. I mean, let's
yeah,
sometimes people
true.
Say the last Aristotelian vestige is that the sun is somehow perfect and unchanging, unmovable. You know, no, the sun is a star. It goes through periods of, to be anthropomorphic, agitation. It goes through periods of quiescence. It goes through periods of strange, from our perspective, activity. The sun was very active at the end of the last ice age with these solar outbursts and whatnot. It went through a period of, I don't want to say dormancy, but being relatively stable, more or less, ever since, for, you know, 8,000 plus years, because it took time after the last ice age for it to calm down and stabilize again. But like any star, it goes through periods of activity. And our sun, I believe, has a cycle of activity on the order of about 12,000 years or so. And in the last century, in the last half century, even there, it's not just me saying this. There are people who independently, astrophysicists who have looked at the solar data, have looked at the isotope data independently, and have pointed out that the sun is all of a sudden becoming quite active again in the last couple of centuries, especially the last 50 years. And it's showing all the same.
What does that mean?
It's showing all the same signs of agitation it did right before the end of the last ice age when you had a major solar outburst. What it means, bottom line, is that we could have another major solar event in the very near future. I would not be surprised, you know, if it happens next year. I won't be surprised personally. I'm not predicting that. But we could be hit by a major solar outburst, coronal mass ejections, solar flares, what's known as a solar proton event, et cetera, et cetera. It would devastate our modern technological society. Frankly, it would wipe out all the electrical grids. It would wipe out all the electronics. It would wipe out all the communication systems. It would mess up our magnetosphere. It would cause high levels of radiation on the surface of the Earth, which is what happened at the end of the last ice age. The way to escape it for those lucky enough would be to go underground, to go into caves, which is what we have at the end of the last ice age, where pockets of humanity were able to escape that way before we went into what I call solar-induced dark age, or SIDA, which in last time around, that lasted from about 9700 BC to about 3500 BC when civilization reemerged again, including
the
reuse of the Sphinx. We should learn from the past.
But what happens in the Dark Ages between that? What happens in that period? There's not enough light on the surface. What can you talk about?
No. It's not so much that there's not enough light on the surface. Things come back to normal from nature's point of view, if you would. But when you've got advanced civilization and it is knocked back to its knees, so to speak, to use a metaphor, and, you know, so many people have been killed, and in many cases, you know, not everyone has all the technology or has all the knowledge, and you lose the critical people, it takes a long time to rebuild. I mean, as an analogy, think about the collapse of the Roman Empire and classical civilization circa 500 AD. It took 1,000 years for that to be, quote, rediscovered, and for the Renaissance to come about. Think about to this day. I know I'll speak for myself. I'm a scientist. I have a PhD. But if all of a sudden, you know, 90% of the people or more around me died and all the technology was wiped out, I can't. And I, even if I had the knowledge, I couldn't reboot civilization in a generation, right, or rebuild computers that have been fried. So these things take time.
You said, though, that mass solar event happened during an ice age or ending.
It ended the ice age.
But we're not in an ice age now. Not that I guess that matters. But
no, it
that,
doesn't matter
does
to
matter?
The sun. Probably what this might, do is actually drive us into an ice age again, or it might just happen in an ice age doesn't come. It's what causes an ice age?
Yeah.
There's a lot of different factors that go into that.
Mm-hmm.
And it partly has to do with the surface of the Earth and the albedo, you know, reflectivity of the Earth, et cetera, et cetera. It could drive us into an ice age again if you had enough precipitation at high latitudes and you built up ice, which has a high reflectivity and then drives temperatures down again. We just don't know, honestly.
And, of course, there is a man-made factor, but you're saying, of course, that big solar output would destroy most technology. So I guess the question is there a way we could prevent that or some insurance to protect ourselves and our technology? I mean, of course, George Norrie's talked about this a lot on his program.
There's nothing we can do to stop the sun from doing whatever it wants to do, except maybe pray to the sun and ask it to be kind and gentle to us. And I'm not even joking about that. I'm serious about that. It's a digression, but there's plenty of evidence that stars may be conscious entities in their own right. The Egyptians actually believed that we become stars, and I think they were talking more than metaphorically. But that's another subject. Maybe at the conference we can talk about things like that.
That would be very exciting. I think that's the future. Of course, there's a lot of ET stuff.
But
getting back to what
do things to harden our system. What that means is to protect it from geomagnetic storms, from solar outbursts, from, you know, plasma charges, that type of thing. But the problem in part is, and one way to do it is to go underground, frankly, to be underground and, you know, with 10 meters of rock above you, that will do a lot to protect hardware, will do a lot to protect things. But we can't put our whole society underground. I have no doubt governments around the world, et cetera, they're aware of what's going on. Obama even did an executive order about this quietly, one of his last executive orders. And, you know, they're preparing. But the average person, what can the average person do? That's a really difficult question. You can't just have your cave 5 hours away from you, because how are you going to get to it in time, even if you know that it's coming, and we may only have hours or a couple of days advance notice if it's picked up before it hits. If you have a solar, some of the major flares and whatnot, they'll essentially act as an EMP, electromagnetic pulse. They'll knock out computers. Most cars nowadays are computers on wheels, effectively. You know, their computer system, the electronic components in the car go. You're not even going to start your car. So it's a ridiculous situation. When you've got all these huge grid lines electrical grid system, that acts as an antenna that picks up the electrons passing by, induces and magnetic fields passing by, and induces electric currents in them over overpowered transformers, which then blow, which, you can't just replace at the moment, huge transformers, high voltage transformers. We have really boxed ourselves into a corner, frankly, as a society. I don't mean to sound negative, but you asked me the question.
No, it's not negative. It's like, if there's a situation, but maybe the more third world countries, the less developed countries, might have an even better chance of maintaining their stability, right?
They absolutely will. They absolutely will. I'll give you a quick analogy to that. I don't want to call it a third world country at all. Romania.
Right.
But I think my wife and I, we were in Romania at one point, doing some research and whatnot, and we were up in the Carpathian Mountains, beautiful in Transylvania, really beautiful area. But you have people there who are living, and I'm not making fun of them, I'm saying this in a complimentary fashion, they still know how to live off the land. They still know how to use an outhouse. They still know how to pump water from a well. They have caves near them that they can retreat to if they want to. Yes, they have their satellite dish and they have their generator to have modern electricity. But frankly, if that goes, they know how to live. And they can be self-sufficient. Now, I live in Boston. No one's self-sufficient here. Electricity goes. Some people not so much Boston, but certainly New York. Electricity goes. Some people couldn't even get up and down the skyscrapers.
Oh, absolutely.
Much less anything else.
would our cell phones be?
No, they'll all be gone. They'll be among the first to go.
They will.
They'll all be fried, and the whole communication system will be gone.
So
there'll be mass panic, too, because no one will be able to contact anyone properly.
So not to be negative or anything, but what could a solar flare like that happen any day, like any time, or is there a build-up and cycle?
No,
it could
happen. It's probably building up. I mean, no one expected the Carrington event in 1859 to all of a sudden happen. They saw the solar flare, which comes in, when you see it, it happened 8 minutes ago because that's how long it takes for the light to travel to Earth. And then the coronal mass ejections hit after that. Now, this 1859, it was relatively minor in terms of the effects on civilization because in 1859, the height of electrical technology was the telegraph system, and it overpowered the telegraph system, burnt down some of the telegraph stations, and some very wealthy people were probably very upset that their messages did not get through and maybe they couldn't place their stock bids or whatever on the stock market. But the average person, it didn't make any difference. Think about today, though. We're not in that situation. The average person has their smartphone. The average person uses electricity, et cetera, et cetera. So in this day and age, the average person, at least in our developed society, is going to be hit very hard and will not know, will be virtually helpless. And, if you have your can of beans and rice, you might not even have a way to cook the rice. So, again, don't want to sound negative, but
no,
you
I know.
Me.
I know. You're,
and
just,
it's, and,
you're just talking about history.
The best thing, I think, to prepare for this is to be talking about it and dealing with it and thinking about it. Because I'm a big one for that, that's what we need to do now. And we need to build communities. We need to build societies of people that are getting prepared for this. And we need to go to a different type of technology. So I'll give you one more example. Nuclear power. What's going to happen during major solar outbursts? You're going to cut off power to nuclear power plants. Now, that sounds ironic because they generate power, but they need to be on the grid system. They need to be cooled consistently. They need to be operating properly. We don't want Fukushimas around the world spewing out radiation. But
so if they're not being cooled, what happens?
they melt down, basically. They start leaking. We saw this in Fukushima, you know, recently. We saw this earlier, Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. Sometimes the term that's used is a progress trap. We've made incredible technological progress, but it's also trapped us into certain ways of behaving and thinking and certain vulnerabilities to natural events that, frankly, in the long run are inevitable. And you know, humans seem to have this hubris, this attitude that, you know, we're invincible, but we're not.
Right. Well, I'm just
so I think, and I wanted to get back to one point. I think something that's really important, and maybe coming out, you know, we can talk about this at the conference and prepare at the conference, is to have communities of people together there thinking about this. And I think also part of it is to be prepared. And I don't want to sound corny, but be prepared philosophically and spiritually.
No, that's
you know,
not
because
corny.
Sometimes
the
best defense is to at least have thought about things ahead of time and to be prepared mentally, spiritually, philosophically, if that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense. And I think that's what a conference like this, the one we're talking about, is in October, the Portal to Ascension Conference. Go to ascensionconference.com, where a lot of speakers present a sort of spiritual, philosophical mindset for dealing with the sort of changes that are
exactly
possible.
And I think we need both. I think we need that, and I think we also need realism as to what really has happened in the past, what really can happen in the future. So sometimes I get, and I'll be honest, I'll get frustrated with people because it's all the spirituality. And there's nothing wrong with that, except there is something wrong when you don't tie it to real life and to real events and to real past, the real potential future. But then you can go the opposite way where, oh, it's all hopeless and we're all going to die and there's nothing beyond. That's do you see what I mean? I think we need a balance.
No, absolutely.
And I think getting back to the ancient Egyptians and John Anthony West and Symbolist Egypt, something that Schwaller talked about in a key term he used translating to English is sacred science, binding the science and the spirituality together as a whole.
What's I'm just curious, I think we're almost out of time, but what has been the history of those types of solar events? Like, how often does it happen? Every 12,000, I think you mentioned, every 20,000
years? Yeah, major ones, I would say about every 12,000 or so years from what I can reconstruct, and then minor ones in between, smaller things in between. It's a bit erratic. We don't know for certain. I suspect that the 1859 Carrington event and some other events since then, for instance, there was a Quebec event in the late 80s that actually caused a major blackout for millions of people. There's been other events since then.
Was that a solar
flare, the sun,
Quebec event?
Yeah, solar flint.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so these things have real ramifications. And I think what we're seeing right now is that the sun is going into or has gone into one of its erratic periods, one of its unstable periods. So, you know, we should not close our eyes to this. We should realize that things are happening and there's the potential there and we better prepare on all levels.
Is it possible that we could develop an electrical system that wouldn't be affected by a solar flare?
No, I think that's virtually impossible. Let me back up. If you want to put it all underground under 10 meters of rock, something like that, maybe you'd have a chance. But, you know, realistically, that's not happening. You have things just low in the ground, like they have buried cables, that type of thing. That's not going to help. I was going to mention things like pipelines. The XL pipeline, that type of thing?
Mm-hmm.
That's going to act as a big cable. It's going to act like a big wire. Plus, it's got gas in it, whether it's liquefied natural gas or whatnot. I mean, the whole thing could explode.
I laugh at
technology because we have not thought about these things and we've just, I tell my students sometimes, because I teach at Boston University, every day, literally, our society is more and more vulnerable to these things, not less vulnerable. And we've made ourselves, put ourselves in a situation, a very precarious situation, collectively.
Wow. It's,
and that's why I think we need to have these discussions and start thinking about alternatives. The sooner the better.
Would zero-point energy, let's say everyone had
that,
a way
that
to
could have some
energy.
Possibilities. That, I think, could have some possibilities. But, again, it depends on how you harness it, because if you use that simply to generate electricity again, then you've got some of the same vulnerabilities. So if you're using that to just run your, you know, conventional electrical grid, more or less using it the same way you might use nuclear power to run a conventional electrical grid, you've still got all the same problems. So
we really have to change
the 4 minutes
grid.
Left.
Okay, 4 minutes left. So this has been incredibly informative and
thank you.
Historic. And where is this major focus of your work now, or where's your work taking you at this moment?
Yeah, this
moment?
Is one of the foci of my work, focuses of my work, because I think we do need to be looking at the future, but I'm also looking at the past. I am one of these people that believes wholeheartedly. It's super, to me, really interesting to look at the past for its own sake, and it's just interesting, but I think it's a lot more than that. I think we look at the past to learn, and not just learn what did they do bad or what did they do wrong and how they were devastated and how do we avoid that, but I think we also look at the past to learn what they knew that we didn't know, what messages they left for us, if you want to put it that way. I'm absolutely convinced that the deep ancients and even the recent ancients, when I say recent ancients, people 3,000-4,000 years ago, had insights, whether it was spiritual, philosophical, I have no doubt they had spiritual and philosophical insights that are useful to us today, that are important to us today.
Well, they had technological insights.
And I think they had technological insights and abilities, too. I mean, you go back to where we started, I think, in part of this conversation. How did they build the Great Pyramid? How did they build the Sphinx Temple in 10,000 BC. The Sphinx Temple, the core of it, is built out of limestone blocks that weigh up to 50 or 100 tons apiece. How did they move them around with incredible tolerances? So you're talking not just spiritual knowledge, you're talking technological knowledge.
Right. No, it's very exciting. So, I mean, your work is really a bridge to our alternative culture, the people who are promoting ideas that there has been an alternative civilization, that that the quackademics, as a tribute to John West, don't know what they're really talking. That we've been given false information, and I think this is part of what will be shared at the Portal to Ascension conference. That is October 5th, 6th, and 7th at the Atrium Hotel in Irvine, California. Go to ascensionconference.com. And then, Robert, where are you going to be speaking? How can people find you?
The best thing is to go to my website. Again, www.robertschoch.com. And that's S-C-H-O-C-H, so www.robertschoch, all one word, .com. Go to my website, and Katie, my wife, and I post everything on that. People can send me a quick email. If they would like to be put on the mailing list, just go to the contact page, and you'll see my email there. If people are interested in, you know, game schedules of speaking or tours, that type of thing. That's really the best way to do it.
And you really did create the world of geoarchaeology, haven't you?
Thank you. Yeah, I'll agree with that.
I mean, and then, of course, Göbekli Tepe, that's a whole other show. But
that's a whole other thing. And I do plan to talk about this some at the conference, but that's something we didn't even really get to.
Tell people what Göbekli Tepe is. It's an ancient civilization they found in Turkey, but what is its significance?
Oh, the significance is it's incredibly sophisticated, just like this what we have in Egypt, and there's no doubt it goes back to before the end of the last ice age, so circa 10,000 BC.
which is, again, pushes human civilization at least 5 or 10,000 years.
Exactly, exactly. When I was first working on the Sphinx, just to wrap mm-hmm. up here, something that they said to me, my academic critics in the early 1990s was, well, if what you're saying is correct, show us another site, another place where you have incredible sophistication at such an early date. Göbekli Tepe had not yet been discovered. Of course, you know, you always have to have a first discovery, and I'll say that was the Sphinx. Since then, Göbekli Tepe has been discovered and absolutely confirms what I've been talking about in terms of civilization going back to a much more remote period.
Well,
and I talk about that in Forgotten Civilization, my book, also.
I've been talking to Robert Schock. We'll go into Göbekli Tepe and the mysteries there, why it was buried at some point. But thank you, Robert, for being on this very informative show. I'm Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. You want to find me, go to my website, newrealities.com, my YouTube, youtube.com/newrealities, and definitely look up the work of Robert Schock. And we'll see everyone at the Portal to Ascension Conference, Irvine, California. Go to ascensionconference.com. This is Portal to Ascension Radio, sponsored and founded by Neil Gore. Thank you for listening today.